When the going gets tough, the tough get growing. Gardens, that is. From the trenches of World War II, or I, to the Warsaw Ghetto and Japanese internment camps of World War II, to the desert sands of Iraq, individuals seeking to turn weakness into strength have turned ruin into garden. And so today we pause to ask, what grows in a garden besides plants?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 602nd edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Santiago who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Nikki, what do you think grows in gardens besides plants?
I would say maybe bacteria.
Bacteria? Okay. Also with us today, producer Carol Stafford. Carol, what do you think grows in gardens besides plants?
Well, when you first asked that question, I was thinking about food gardens. And then I thought, well, flower gardens count too. So I tried to get something that was, you know, universal. And I thought, gardeners.
Gardeners grow in gardens besides plants. Very good. Folks, this from Nelson Mandela's Long Walk to Freedom. The Bible tells us that gardens preceded gardeners, but that was not the case at Pulsmore Prison. Within a few weeks of surveying all the empty space we had on the guard prison's roof and how it was bathed in sunlight the whole day, I decided to start a garden and received permission to do so from the commanding officer. Each morning I put on a straw hat and some rough gloves and worked in the garden for 2 hours. Every Sunday I would supply vegetables to the guard kitchen so that they could cook a special meal for the common law prisoners. I also gave quite a lot of my harvest to the warders, who used to bring satchels to take away their fresh vegetables. A garden was one of the few things in prison that one could control. To plant a seed, watch it grow, to tend it, and then harvest it, offered a simple but enduring satisfaction. The sense of being the custodian of this small patch of earth offered a taste of freedom. When the going gets tough, the tough do get going to gardens. Today we ask why. What else grows in a garden besides plants? Here to help us dig for an answer, we have University of Oregon professor Kenneth Helpand, who is the author of Defiant Gardens. Kenneth, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning, Michael.
Professor of Landscape Architecture, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So do you teach landscape architecture, or do you teach the history of landscape architecture?
I teach both. I teach the history of landscape architecture and courses on landscape history and theory, but I also teach design courses, yeah.
Okay, good. I have two kind of personal questions to help us get to know you before we move on.
Sure.
One of them, if you had to select one garden in the world in which to spend the rest of your life, which garden would it be?
That's not a very fair question. I get this all the time from students and people traveling, and what's your favorite garden and so on. And I always have to narrow it down by country and place and experience. If I had to kind of say it, I'd say Central Park.
In New York City.
Yeah. So I'm originally from New York, and it's New York's greatest garden.
Okay, good. I think mine would be Yellowstone Park, because I'm from Montana.
That's not bad either.
Also, it has a little bit more room.
Yeah,
The other question, what would our lives be like here in the city without ornamental plants and gardens?
Oh, I think our lives, both in the city and towns and countryside, would be radically diminished. I mean, people have a profound connection to nature at all sizes and scales. And not having that opportunity, whether it's even a single potted plant, to larger spaces, to the most vast spaces, diminishes people. And I think the reason you see gardens and gardening is so popular is that we all feel that a basic need for that connection, either to do it or just to witness it.
Yeah, you know, I have a a friend that I interviewed for my book Metro Farm. He's a propagator of ornamental plants, and and I said, well, hey, why do people buy? What would happen if we just didn't have ornamental? We don't really need them to get by. It's and he looked at me and he said, do you know what would happen to people if they didn't have plants, ornamental plants, if they didn't have gardens? You just go to a slum where there are no gardens and look and see what has happened to the people there. They'll have two wrecked cars in their front yard, and there'll be beer cans laying all over the place, and that's what happens to people when they don't have plants.
There's actually research that was done actually in housing projects in Chicago, horrible housing projects, public housing projects, where identical courtyards were studied, and they were identical with the exception of that one had literally just a single tree, being the only green, and the other had just concrete. And the difference in patterns of socialization, of kids playing, of people's general sense of contentment was dramatically different just because of that single tree.
One tree. Wow. Wasn't there a story or a play or something like that, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn?
Yeah, The Tree Grows in Brooklyn, which is the tree of heaven, Nyalanthus altissima, which it breaks through the concrete. And in the story of, I actually grew up in Brooklyn, so but at least till I was 10. In the story, the tree is continually chopped down and burned and mutilated, and it eventually regenerates. And the same thing happens to the characters. The main character in the book, and she is kind of chopped down and, you know, eventually rises up, you know, like a phoenix, and the tree does the same kind of thing. And I think often in the city, in particularly in kind of difficult environments, whether it's the city or some other environment that's difficult in terms of its environment or lack of water or lack of plants, when we see, you know, a plant, you know, breaking through something or thriving in those environments, we identify with that, I think, in dramatic ways.
And you write about war gardens. Wow.
Yeah.
I've never heard the expression war gardens before, but that's what you write about. You write about them from World War One all the way through Iraq.
Right.
What's the difference? You know, most of us, of course, have heard about victory gardens.
Right.
What's the difference between a war garden and a victory garden?
Well, actually, victory gardens were originally called war gardens in the First World War, and the victory garden name only came later.
Mm-hmm.
But my research is not about victory gardens, which are about gardens on the home front. And they were incredibly important and still are obviously incredibly important and interesting. I was interested in gardens that were in war environments or taking place during wartime in those situations. And the basic premise was similar to the way that philosophers and psychologists and theologians have looked at people in extreme circumstances, and maybe that's tells us something about the essence of the human condition, of what we are like as human beings, that if I looked at gardens in these extreme situations, it might tell me something about what gardens meant to people. And my main concern and interest was what did gardens mean to people? And by looking at them in the most extreme circumstance, and war is the most extreme human circumstance, I thought I would learn something about that. And I did.
And you did.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Is there a difference throughout history, then, of the impact of these war gardens on the lives of people, or is it kind of the same?
Well, I mean, there's obviously different historical circumstances.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess that's what I'm asking. Does the circumstances rule, or is it the garden that rules?
Well, there's some combination, of course, but I came to the conclusion that there were five seemingly simple lessons or meanings that came out of looking at these places. And every place
Hold on to those, okay?
Okay, yeah, don't worry. but the place, I should tell you, the places I looked at were gardens built behind the trenches in the First World War, actually on both sides of the line. Gardens built in the ghettos under the Nazis during World War II. Gardens built in prisoner of war and civilian internment camps in both World Wars. And gardens built by Japanese Americans interned in this country during the Second World War. And then I also kind of brought it up to date with some information actually about Iraq and Afghanistan.
And it seems like we have seen newspaper articles or clippings or photographs from the front in Iraq, and we see farmer soldiers growing things in circumstances that just otherwise wouldn't make much sense at all.
Well, they make sense. I mean, they may not make sense, you know, kind of vegetal sense,
right.
But they make psychological sense in dramatic ways.
And one of the pictures included that I saw was a soldier kneeling down in front of his tent where he had 1 square foot of grass growing, and he's clipping it with his little scissors.
That wonderful picture, which is also in my book, kind of made the rounds of the internet, and eventually discovered who it was. It was actually a soldier originally from Oregon, where I live, but was stationed in Hawaii, and he wrote back home that he actually wanted to have grass, so he could just kind of essentially, you know, put his feet in the grass or look at something green in this not very green environment where he was. So he wrote back home and had grass seeds sent. He planted that, and that didn't work. He really didn't know what to do with that in outside of Baghdad. And I don't know how this, I don't know the answer to, somehow this soldier acquired sod in Iraq.
And somehow he got it. Of course, we have to take a quick break. Folks,
sure.
This is The Food Chain. We have Professor, Kenneth Halpin, University of Oregon, author of Defiant Gardens, and you. What grows in gardens besides plants? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back. This is The Food Chain, and I am Michael Olson. Folks, when the going gets tough, the tough get growing. Gardens. From the trenches of World War I to the internment camps of World War II to the desert sands of Iraq. And so today we pause to ask, what grows in a garden besides plants? What are these people doing growing in conditions that are often just utter chaos, if not worse? What do they get from those gardens besides plants? We'd like to hear from you today. We're looking for a one-word answer to what you think grows in gardens besides plants. Carol says, gardeners. And you say, bacteria.
That was my best guess.
Bacteria? Well, bacteria grow in gardens, too. And we're with Professor Kenneth Halpin, who is the professor of landscape architecture at the University of Oregon. What a fun thing to teach that must be.
It's a wonderful thing to teach, and it's a wonderful profession.
I guess so. And because you're doing gardens. There was a gardener that came through yesterday, and I asked her, What grows in gardens besides her plants? And she said, without a second's hesitation, spirit.
Mm-hmm. That would make sense. Yes.
That would make sense, too. So let's talk a little bit about how people defy the chaos of war by gardening. Let's go back to the trenches of World War I and tell us a little bit about World War I for those people who don't know what the characteristic of combat was like in the theater.
One of the prerequisites for having a garden during wartime, or having a garden anywhere, is you need the time and the space to do it.
Yeah.
So if you're an army on the march, people are not creating gardens. But if you're in a stable situation, and during the First World War, there was a line of trenches almost 500 miles long that went from essentially the English Channel to Switzerland. And along that line, there were millions of soldiers essentially who dug in for a period of almost 4 years, and many people did create gardens. What is most dramatic about them is between these lines of trenches was the space that was known as no man's land, which was literally hell on earth, a place where nature was completely obliterated. It was bombed, it was mutilated, and literally anyone who entered it literally would be mowed down by machine guns. Behind those lines, people made gardens. And actually, my research here began with a single old stereo photograph I found years ago, which was entitled "Gardens with Shelters with Gardens Behind in the French Trenches." And it shows a few blasted trees and then a few soldiers kind of standing there outside of their dugouts, and then these small little vegetable gardens that were there. And I had that picture on my kind of shelf in front of my books for years, and the image of it festered, because I knew that this meant something very important. And when I finally decided to research it, I began first with the First World War and discovered much more than I ever imagined.
Now, you had this photograph in front of you for years and years.
Yes.
Why?
Because I knew that, I mean, the contrast of having a garden in what I knew was this horrible and literally hellish environment meant more, you know, was something that was significant. And one of the most common ways of thinking about gardens is that the garden is an ideal landscape, mm-hmm. that the garden is a kind of paradise. Well, what happens when you have paradise immediately adjacent to hell? So what is a kind of ordinary, very mundane, prosaic garden and people using it, its meaning is dramatized by that contrast. And I think war or any difficult circumstance. I use the term defiant gardens because this may be a defiance against cultural conditions, economic conditions, environmental, psychological conditions, where the garden is an assertive action, where the garden isn't something that's passive, where
but
the garden
it's kind
is
of
something
like,
that's active.
It's kind of like Nelson Mandela was saying.
Mandela's garden, and I talk about that in my book, Mandela did that as a very assertive action, and also, he, as you quoted at the beginning, when he was working in the garden was the only time he said he actually felt free, and even though he was a prisoner. And we have modern programs like that. There are prison garden programs actually begun mm-hmm. originally in California and prisons in the United States and other parts of the world. And those gardens, which if you just looked at them, might look very ordinary, but the fact that they're in a prison and they're being tended by individuals who are inmates in those places, their meaning and significance is dramatized.
Going back to the trenches of World War One, did you find any accounts or people talking about any recorded conversations?
Absolutely. For everything, for all of my research, I relied entirely on first-person accounts,
mm-hmm.
on people's diaries, on memoirs, either people who directly made these places or people who had witnessed them.
Can you give us an interesting account from one of those gardens?
From World War One, or
from World War One?
From World War One, there was actually a remarkable space created just outside, just in the town of Ypres. Ypres was the scene of some of the most horrific fighting of the First World War. Actually, some of the most horrific fighting in human history. And in this town, which was bombed regularly and right behind the lines, there was a place known as the Tock House or the Talbot House, which functioned the way it was a British place, the way an American USO would function, as a respite for soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And you entered this place, and there was some, you know, recreational rooms and a chapel, and then the building is still there and is still used, in fact. And you went through a conservatory, and on the door as you entered the garden in the rear, there's a sign. The sign is still there. The sign says, "Come into the garden and forget about the war."
Mm.
That somehow, you know, being in this little place could offer a kind of respite for individuals. Individuals in their diaries would talk about looking across no man's land where this environment is completely obliterated and seeing a tree with a single leaf, seeing literally, you know, a blade of grass, seeing something that was green and commenting on that and what that meant to them.
Just seeing that leaf. And of course,
seeing
the trees
that was alive.
The trees that you have pictured in this photograph, the stereo mm-hmm. photograph that you have, the trees are all without leaves. Is that
right.
from winter or is that from being...
Well, in that particular photograph, it's probably winter, but if you look at the later in the book, you'll see images of trees that essentially have been blasted.
Mm-hmm.
If one hasn't seen those in wartime photographs, it would be like after a forest fire. It has that look to it.
Well, how did they go about gardening in these incredible circumstances, though?
Well, right behind the lines. I mean, the word battlefield essentially comes from the word field.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, most of our battles, historically, have taken place in fields, in what was the agricultural landscape, Gettysburg, if you want a kind of
right.
American
right.
example. So you have land here where there is soil. It's not necessarily good or terrific, but there's something to grow. And in the First World War, believe it or not, people would write home for seeds. And seeds were provided for soldiers. They wrote home. They wrote, I have letters from individuals writing for garden manuals and books.
You might mean
be farther behind the lines, that bases, just a mile or two behind the lines, in bases and tent encampments. They created gardens, even had gardening competitions within certain battalions and companies, which was rather amazing. I mean, obviously amazing when you think about it. There's another example from the First World War, which is a civilian internment camp. In the First World War, when the war began, British and Commonwealth civilians who were resident in Berlin were imprisoned. Similarly, German citizens who were in London were imprisoned for the duration of the war. And there was a camp called Ruhleben just outside of Berlin, which was a former stable, racetrack and stables, where about 7,000 men were imprisoned for the duration of the war. And they transformed this place. Largely, the whole infield of what was the racetrack, they made the entire thing was a garden and ponds. They had regular garden competitions for the best garden in a barrack. And believe it or not, they formed a chapter of the Royal Horticultural Society. And I have the minutes of their meeting. The British were rather amazing.
Well, folks, this is the Food Chain. Today we're talking about war gardens, and we're talking about why people in extraordinarily terrible situations plant seeds and grow gardens, and what they get out of those gardens besides plants. And we're curious to hear what you think they would get. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Pick up your phone and join us today. We have Professor Kenneth Helpand, who is with the University of Oregon, teaches landscape architecture, and he's also the author of Defiant Gardens. Right back. Do stay tuned.
Thank you.
So what do you get out of your garden besides plant matter? Now, of what we've heard earlier today, there are a lot of things that you can get out of your garden. Survival being one of them. We're with Professor Kenneth Helpand today, who is the author of Defiant Gardens, and we're looking at some of the war gardens in history, which is to say gardens planted amidst the chaos and ruin of war. Professor Helpand, take us back to World War II. Tell us, essentially, you looked at two different situations in World War II, the Warsaw Ghetto and the Japanese internment camps. Different in character there. Though they were both internment camps, there was a whole different world in each camp, correct?
Well, the ghettos of World War II, the ghettos were very different, as horrible as the internment camps of this country were. The ghettos of Europe were extermination camps. The idea was to exterminate the Jewish population of Europe. And that was part of what the ghettos were about. People were herded into them and systematically starved to death. And then the few remaining inhabitants were then brought to their extermination. In those ghettos, rather amazingly, in Warsaw and other ghettos, individuals created gardens. And when I discovered this, I found it rather amazing. There was an organization in the garden in the ghettos called the Toporol, which appropriated any available land, which was mostly kind of bombed out areas and any kind of vacant space. They tried to kind of remove rubble. They acquired seeds, which often was something that took, you know, you risked your life to do. And they kind of orchestrated kind of garden making. And if this organization, again, I have their minutes, in believe it or not, in the Warsaw Ghetto in 1942, they are talking about growing things so that the children in the ghetto would have contact with nature and how important that was. And this is in a circumstance where individuals are being starved to death on purpose. And one of the kind of conclusions of kind of looking at this was how significant kind of gardens are to people beyond food. And I don't make any distinction between vegetable gardens and ornamental gardens. I think that's a kind of spurious distinction. They both sustain us in different and related ways. Mm-hmm. And just having something growing there, particularly as a sign of hope. I'll tell you one story. A woman that I spoke, I interviewed a woman named Esther Mishkin, who was 16 at the time in the Lodz ghetto, which was the second largest ghetto after Warsaw. And her father had a garden in the ghetto, and she told me the story of how her father, I asked her, did she work in it? She said, no, I really didn't work in it. It was my father's. And she told me she would sit there watching her father watch the garden. And then she said, watching the garden grow, that gave him the feeling that somehow we might survive. It was essentially a symbol of hope. Sadly, she's the only member of her family who survived the war.
And this was significantly different than the Japanese internment camps, correct? Because it was a terminal place. I mean, it was the end.
And believe it or not, even people knew that at a certain point, and they still created these places. Rather extraordinary. Now, just another story before I talk about the Japanese-American experience.
Okay.
I interviewed a woman named Gerda Klein, who was in a slave labor camp during the war and a series of concentration camps. And the last camp she was in, there were 2,000 young women there, and every morning they were marched from a barracks to the factory where they worked. And as they marched, they walked by the commandant's house. And in this, at the edge of that, there was a rose garden. And she and other women looked at this, just wanting to go out and smell it and touch it and look, you know, do something more than look at it. But they knew, literally, if they stepped out of line, they would have been shot. She describes how one morning on this walk, a crocus had broken through the concrete. And that all of these women silently walked around it so as not to crush them.
Wow.
And the Japanese American experience was radically
just
different.
Before you do, let's go quickly to the phones and talk with Rich.
Sure.
He has a couple of answers for our question: what grows in a garden besides plant matter? Rick?
Yes. Well, I actually got two one-word answers and one two-word answer. And the first one is life, especially in a war zone, because everything's dying around you. So if you can grow something that's the opposite of what you're dealing with. And the second is normalcy, something that's normal that you would find in your normal life. And the two-word answer is mental health, trying to keep your sanity about yourself with everything around you going crazy.
Then you could just condense that to sanity.
Yeah. If you want a one-word answer, and I did ask why a one-word answer.
Well, there you go. Thank you very much for the call, Rich.
Two other things real quick, though.
Yeah.
Over here in Salinas, Dorothy's Kitchen, which is the place where the homeless go for food, they have started a garden across the street down the corner. And a lot of the people that work in the kitchen or a lot of the homeless work there in conjunction with Hartnell College.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been growing a garden now this past year. I think they started it last year, and they've been doing it full-time this year. So it's like a war zone down there with the drugs and the alcohol and all this stuff going on. And so they have their little garden, and they go out there and keep their sanity, too. And then over at the VA hospital in Palo Alto, there's a little courtyard, no vegetables there, but it's a courtyard. So when you step off the elevator on any floor, you can look into the courtyard. You have a bunch of trees in there with benches, and I'm sure the patients that are at the hospital use that, too, to get some part of normalcy just to get away from the hospital environment.
Good points, Rich. Thank you for the call. Really appreciate it. In the cities. Let's go quickly to the Japanese internment camps and draw that distinction between the Jewish internment camps and the...
Well, the Jewish camps were not internment camps. They were extermination
camps.
It's an important distinction. In the Japanese-American experience, I mean, I think most people, certainly on the West Coast, know that the shameful history in the United States. 120,000 Japanese-Americans, 60 to 70% of whom were actually American citizens. The others actually could have been. They just weren't allowed to become kind of citizens, were interned for the duration of the war. And it was individuals living in Washington, Oregon, California, and parts of Arizona. Only if you lived in those places, if you lived in the rest of the country, you were not interred. And they were interned mostly in remote sites in the American West.
And these were real desert settings.
They were, with the exception of two camps in kind of swampy Arkansas, they were all in desert locations. The best known but not the largest was Manzanar, which is in the Owen Valley in California, which is now a National Historic Site. I'm not sure that most listeners probably don't know that before the Second World War, Japanese Americans on the West Coast in Vancouver and Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Southern California were really the mainstay of the kind of landscape gardening and kind of gardener
profession. Absolutely.
So you had a group of individuals who were now kind of shipped off to these horrific places who were incredibly skillful and incredibly sophisticated in terms of their garden making skills and their garden design skills. And in the camps, oddly, the kind of U.S. Kind of forces allowed and actually encouraged individuals to transform the place. They wanted these places to be self-sufficient. And they were all abandoned after the war, but Manzanar, where there's been an archaeological investigation of the entire site, they discovered that in front of every barracks, in front of every open space, gardens were created.
Wow.
And using whatever meager materials people had, the stones that were there at Manzanar, those who were in turn built a two-mile-long irrigation ditch capturing water from the base of the Sierras. At a certain point, individuals were allowed outside of camp and used the surrounding landscape to gather shrubs, trees, and stones that were brought back into the camp. And essentially, they, we might say, kind of beautified them. More importantly, they made a place that was kind of an indeterminate home into their home. And also, in the camps, one was not allowed, all official work had to take place in English.
Hold on to that, will you?
Sure.
We have to take a quick break. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080, right back. Well, we're talking about the internment camps for the Japanese people in World War II, and getting pretty interesting right when the break came, so let's go back to Professor Kenneth Helpand and have him finish his comments about the Japanese internment camps. Professor, you were talking about how right in front of each barracks there was a garden.
In front of each barracks, essentially, there was a garden. Every 10 barracks had a mess hall. In front of every mess hall, there was a garden. In front of the churches and temples and judo halls, there was a garden. In Manzanar, there's a one-acre park that was constructed, which was rather extraordinary in its design. There were also victory gardens, and also at least some of the camps had kind of agricultural kind of gardens.
Mm-hmm.
As well. I was saying that in the camps, one had to not speak English, but all official work had to be done in English. And essentially, creating a garden was a way of kind of speaking one's own cultural language.
Oh.
And an act of assertion, and in a sense, also an act of resistance. Because it's visible, it was in your face. And kind of ironically, eventually, the camp authorities looked at these, you know, would take people to tour the camps and show, you know, how nice it was and how people were being treated well. Of course, they were not. But more importantly is what these things meant to people. One story, there was a Mr. Kogita, Yasusuke Kogita, who was from Seattle. And at his home in Seattle, he had a garden, and he and his family were sent to the Minidoka camp in Idaho. And at this camp, he built a garden at one point, even kind of going out, acquired a stone, a one-ton stone, and his sons, who were young children at the time, describe how the garden helped him survive this experience. At the end of the war, when individuals were interned, they were only allowed to take very minimal possessions. But believe it or not, our government, when people left the camps, they shipped them home. Mr. Kogita had his garden shipped home. He had the stones wrapped and sent home. He rebuilt his garden back at his home in Seattle. After he passed away, his sons acquired those stones. They now stand at their homes, essentially, as family heirlooms.
Wow. Let's go quickly to the phones. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Professor Kenneth Helpand, who's the author of Defiant Gardens. Let's go quickly to Rolf. Rolf, welcome to The Food Chain.
Morning.
Morning.
This is the dynamic farmer from the high plains of the Rockies.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to briefly say, I think the most significant element that grows out of gardening is the spirit of independence of people. Independence and self-sufficiency. And I say that because as a child, I grew up in the French-Swiss-German borders and the farmland of significance in the Rhine Valley, but the fact that out of the bombing craters where the water collected came these various types of peripherally gardens and the sense that people, even though my family, we were fortunately better off, but still of being able to grow things without government interference, without occupying forces, and then that spirit of a self-sufficiency. And secondarily, I want to say that...
Let me have the professor comment on that. Ken?
Well, I think, as I said, self-sufficiency is a form of defiance. It is a form of kind of asserting who you are, asserting your independence, asserting your control in often in uncontrollable circumstances. So absolutely. It is also a communal activity.
Right.
Not all gardening is done individually. Most of it actually you need other people to do it if it's any scale. So it has both aspects of that. It can be personally satisfying individually and at the same time a dramatic link to other individuals,
yep.
both in the making of it and then and also in the sharing of the experience, whether you're the maker or one just kind of passing through the place.
Rolf?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I've as a very small child, I lived through it. And secondarily, totally differently, what I wanted to share is that I had some exposure to the American military in Alaska. Interesting enough, it's just really discussed, maybe it'll be discussed more, that we have this marvelous woman, Palin, in the process. It is some of the most intense farming in this nation.
In Alaska?
Yeah. And what that does for those people in Alaska, because, you know, the very short, intense growing season, and yet the remoteness and these very, very high prices, anything they get from down here.
Amen.
So there is an interesting thing of modern independence.
That goes back to your self-sufficiency, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Rolf, thank you for the call. Let's go quickly to Kate. Kate, welcome to the Food Chain. You've got Professor Kenneth Halpin and Michael Olson. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, I wanted to say several months ago, I got your book, Defiant Gardens, and it is fantastic.
Thank you.
It's so moving and illuminating, and I hope everyone who listens to this program goes out and gets it as well. I've worked in the field of horticultural therapy myself, and I just wanted to say, I guess some of the things that I've seen is that certainly what's grown in gardens are it's hope and perseverance and balance, and I know it's not one word, but the term consolation of mortality, I think, are some of the things that really we feel when we're in gardens.
What did you say, consolation?
Consolation of mortality.
Mm-hmm. You know, what does that mean?
Well, you know, you think about that one of the things that every being shares is that we all are going to die. We know this is so, and we know our loved ones are going to die. And, of course, a garden, as what was said earlier, is the ultimate symbol and actual reality of life. And so it's a way, I think, when we work in a garden, that we are able to deal with the fact that we're all mortal.
Kate?
Yes.
You may call this program anytime.
Thank you very much. That was very wonderful.
Thank you so much for your beautiful book and all the work you did on it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. We're talking with Professor Kenneth Halpin. The book is Defiant Gardens, and we're talking about where ruins take over, gardens come back, and it's people that plant them, and what do we get from them? Right back. So when the going gets tough, the tough get growing. Gardens, that is. From the trenches of World War I to the Warsaw Ghetto and Japanese internment camps of World War II to the desert sands of Iraq, every individual seeking to turn weakness into strength have turned ruin into gardens. And today we're asking what grows in a garden besides plants. And we're digging around, as it were, with Professor Kenneth Halpin of the University of Oregon and the author of Defiant Gardens. Professor Halpin, I think you have the ideal description of what comes out of gardens, and that is defiance.
Well, I think that the act of defiance, this kind of assertiveness, is something that's present in all gardens. It's just magnified in very difficult circumstances. And you've been asking listeners to give one word of what they think gardens mm-hmm. are about. After doing all this research and analysis and meeting people and going to places, I came to the conclusion that gardens were about five simple things and five simple words. They were about life, the connection to the kind of the organic world that we're part of and it's around us. They are about home, either the making of home or gardens as a reminder of homes that we've occupied. They're about hope, dramatically. All plant life, as humans have dealt with, is often about hope. You put a seed in the ground with the expectation and hope that it's going to mature. They're about work, the pleasures and joys of work and the satisfaction of labor, and they're dramatically about beauty. And for different individuals, these will be in different proportions, but all of those things are essential. And I think present in all garden making.
You know, there's a gal who calls herself the Seed Lady of Watts, Anna Marie Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And after the Rodney King riots in South Central, she set about becoming the garden person and encouraging gardens in the real tough neighborhoods of South Central L.A. And all of the, when you talk with Anna Maria, she brings up the five names that you just listed as well. And in putting them all together, there is a defiance about her that is so magnificent, you know, that that I'm not going to take this.
No, I'm not going to take it.
Destitution. I'm not going to put up with it. I'm going to defy it, and I'm going to do it with gardens.
And I think the community garden movement in America is a dramatic example of this, and particularly in inner cities, where people have chosen not to accept the environment that they live in or been given or forced into. And certainly gardening is one way. It's not the only way. Others will find kind of defiant and assertive and political and economic actions in other arenas. But for certain individuals, for many individuals, it is one way of both coping with situations, trying to create, as someone of you as they mentioned, a kind of normalcy about places. And it is also good for you. It is good for one's mental health and good for one's physical health. I always come back to the first description, at least in the Western world, of a garden in Eden, in Genesis. And the first commentary about a garden is that it had in Eden everything that was good to look at and good to eat. So all gardens were always a combination of the pragmatic, the good to eat, the useful to us, and good to look at. It was a beautiful place, aesthetic, and it's a pair. And I always like the fact that good to look at is placed first.
Amen. Professor Kenneth Helfand, thank you so much. The book? What is your book?
Oh, Defiant Gardens. Making Gardens in Wartime. It is now out in a second hardcover edition, and a paperback edition is just out, and you can get it hopefully at your local bookstore or Amazon for sure.
Thanks for joining us.
There's also a website, defiantgardens.com.
Thank you for joining us, and thank you out there for tuning in as well. See you next week.
Michael.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.